Okay, we're beginning here on the second line on the top of Kuf Lamed Aleph Amud Aleph. The Gemara concluded yesterday pretty definitively that the halacha is like Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, which is that an individual has the right to redistribute the assets of the Yerusha amongst those that would be the rightful heirs min HaTorah. So that means ben Abanim, bat ben Abanot. You can reallocate the percentages given that they are a rightful heir to this individual. The question now raised is, Boi Rova, Bibari Heach. When you're dealing with a healthy person, how does this work? The way that the Rishbam explains the question is that the source for the fact that Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka says you have a right to redistribute the assets is Veya Beyom Hanchilo et Banav. So that's on the day that he gives over the Yerusha to his children. So the statement in the Torah seems to dealing with an individual who is passing away, a Shechiv Meira, and he's allocating his assets. He's allocating his Yerusha. So the nature of the question now is, what's the story with a Bari? What's the story with a healthy individual? So that could be manifest in a number of ways. It's hard to really understand the direction of the Gemara or the direction of the question, but the Rishonim ask it in a number of ways. One of which is, with regards to a Bari, we know that you can't use the same mechanisms for conveying Yerusha or properties as you can with a Shechiv Meira. The Shechiv Meira, when he grants the property, his Dvarav is Kemisurim Dami. That when he speaks and he articulates that which he is saying, he's able to convey or to change the allocation simply by speaking, because the Chachamim empowered a Shechiv Meira to do such. With a Bari, that's not the case. A Bari in general requires a kinyan and requires the normal trappings that you would associate with the gifting or the giving of items. So according to like the Rashbam over here, it seems to me the question is, can a Bari function in the same way as a Shechiv Meira in this instance? Normally we would require a Bari who's giving a gift to have a kinyan to facilitate the transfer of ownership from the individual to whomever he is gifting it. On the other hand, by Shechiv Meira, he simply has to state it for it to happen. But now, here, according to Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, the way that you move around the Yerusha has nothing to do with gifting, it's all about Yerusha. So then, if you're a Shechiv Meira, I understand. You're dealing with Yerusha, you're dealing with the Shechiv Meira, you can do that through articulation, and that would work. On the other hand, if you're dealing with a Bari, who normally requires a Kinyan, but nevertheless, here you're not dealing with a Matana, you're dealing with Yerusha. Can the Bari function in the same way that the Shechiv Meira functions? Can he just simply articulate, this is how he wants the Yerusha allocated? And then based on that, it would be a binding statement. Even though there's no Kinyan, even though there's not the trappings that you would expect by a Bari. So that's the nature of the question according to the Rashbam. And obviously, if he's a Bari that's doing this, he could change his mind later on. By Shechiv Meira, the assumption is that he's going to pass away. And so therefore, whatever he says now is going to be binding, and that's the last will that he is giving. By Bari, he's got plenty of years to go. That means that he could reallocate based on this. And we know that people do that many times in their will. They change their will many times. Over here, you're not talking about a written document. You're talking about somebody who's articulating, verbally expressing their will as to how the Yerusha will be allocated. And based on this question, the idea would be that a Bari would be able to do this and then be able to change his mind a number of times before the death of that individual. So you can see that in the Rashbam, he says, Bari she'amar ploni yirash sedeh plonit. Mi'amar Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka dekani kevin d'ra'i liyosho. So you see that the Rashbam is focused on the verbalization, the articulation being the same way a Shechiv Meira would do it, which is simply stating something. And is that binding by a Bari like it is by a Shechiv Meira? That's the nature of the question according to the Rashbam. Others see the question based on the difference between a Shechiv Meira and a Bari. A Shechiv Meira acting as a Shechiv Meira can grant Yerusha that way. A Bari acting like a Bari, can he reallocate the Yerusha the way that a Bari does, which is through a Kinyan? He would have to do the way or function the way that a normal Bari would do. In that context, can or in that capacity, can he do this? So that's other Rishonim believe. Just like a Shechiv Meira could do it through articulation, can a Bari do it through a Kinyan? Can Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka's din be accomplished by the Bari the way that it is accomplished by a Shechiv Meira? So even though normally you cannot gift something, even with a Kinyan and a Shtar after death, because a kinyan or a shtar is only effective now, not after death. The question is, can this work in this instance? Because the mechanism is Yerusha in the end, because it's using Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka's din. And therefore, even though normally this wouldn't work for Yerusha, maybe in this instance it does work for Yerusha by a bari. Or even if you did it in a way that would make it effective, which is you said, me'achshav ulachar mita, which would make it that it's effective from today, only one upon the death of the individual, since you've used the Lashon Yerusha, is that still work over here? Because normally a bari can only gift through a matana, not Yerusha. So that's the three different ways to explain with regards to what the question is about whether Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka's din applies to a bari. That's the nature of the question. So the Gemara expresses it. Kikama Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka mishchimera. When Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka made his statement, it was about a shchimera debar oretehu, because he is someone who is engaged in the issue of Yerusha. He is somebody who is on the verge of passing away. He's someone who is thinking about Yerusha. He's also someone who is b'yom hanchilo et banav. That is the right time period. Aval barilo, a bari who's not in the world of Yerusha and is not a b'yom hanchilo et banav. Maybe he's not empowered. Or dilma afilu b'bari nami. Maybe it also applies to a bari. The timing isn't so important. Normally, that's when people do such a thing. Therefore, the Torah writes it derech bnei adam, which is b'yom hanchilo et banav. But that's not a limiting factor, which is that it can only be done then. Maybe it can be done even earlier by a bari. Amar le Rav Misharshia the Rava. Tashma, I'll bring you a proof. Da amar lo Rabbi Natan the Rabbi. So Rabbi Natan, you can see here in both in the Rashbam, as well as the Perush Rashbam Ikari, that Rabbi Natan made aliyah from Bavel to Eretz Yisrael, and he was known as Rabbi Natan HaBavli because of his origins in Bavel. He is from the earlier groups of individuals in Bavel who are known in the time of the Tanaim. In general, we don't find the Tanaim from Bavel. The Tanaim are local in Eretz Yisrael. Later on in the Amoraim, we find a split. We have Amoraim in Eretz Yisrael, we have Amoraim in Bavel. But here, Rabbi Natan stands out as being from Bavel, and therefore he is Rabbi Natan HaBavli. Not only is he unique in that way, he also happens to be, but he was a generation older than Rabbi. He was a peer of Rabbi's father. So now he comes and queries of Rabbi. Shenitim mishnatchem k'Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. You set up your Mishnah like Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. The way the Rashbam is explaining it is, Rabbi, after he was misader of the Mishnah, Rabbi Natan was commenting on Rabbi's canonization of the Mishnah, or the way that he structurally set up the Mishnah. He's saying the way that you did this ends up paskening like Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. Now Rabbi Natan ben Abavli could be asking this for two reasons. One reason is he believes Allah is not like Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, and that could be the reason that he's querying Rabbi and saying, why are you saying the Allah is like Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka? We know that Rabbi believes that because he saw that on yesterday's daf. Amar Abzrika, Amar Rabbi, that was the quote that we had. Halacha ke Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. So we know that Rabbi believes that. So Rabbi Natan's question could derive from the fact that he believes the halacha is not like that. Or his question to Rabbi could be a more generic nature, which is, even if you believe the halacha is like Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, why did you set up a Mishnah to be only like Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka? In general, we will try our best to include as many opinions as possible when we're writing about a Mishnah. Even though the halacha is like Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, we'll see in a second the instance where this happens, you could have easily, or you should have easily, included other Tanaim. So why limit that Mishnah to the view of Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka? So in one instance, it could be a fundamental question about the halacha. In the other case, it could just be a stylistic question, which is, why did you make this Mishnah like Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka? Titnan, this is the Mishnah from Ketubot that he's speaking about. Lo katav la bnin dichrin. If he did not include this language in the Ketubah, this language which is known as Ketubat Benin Dichrin, the Ketubah of the male children, we did this in Ketubah together, we'll review it in a second, just to remind ourselves of what it is. Yoter al-chukayon dimachahun, a greater portion that their brothers have, chayav, it works anyway, it happens anyway, shetanai beitin hu. Because it is a condition of Beitin, it is something that Beitin imposed into the marriage. it's something that should be included in the ketubah. You don't include it in the ketubah, it's included anyway, because Beit Din instituted that every marriage should be premised on this being a part and parcel of the ketubah. This is what's otherwise known as ketubat binin dechrin, is the ketubah for the male children. In a society where you have polygamy, where you have individuals marrying multiple wives, then you have a chance a person will have multiple wives, children from all of these wives, and when it comes to the passing of that individual, his property then will be split up amongst all of his male children. Those male children may not have the same mother, even though they share a common father. That means that assets that are coming from different families will all end up getting distributed amongst the male children and end up, in essence, in different families. So what you have here now is a problem faced by fathers-in-law. When they marry off their daughter, they're going to give dowries or they're going to give money into the marriage that's associated with the ketubah. But now they know that there's a risk that if their daughter predeceases her husband, which in that day was a very common thing to happen, especially given the difficulties of childbirth, then the husband will inherit that woman. Then afterwards, when the husband passes away, then all of that what was given to his daughter will be divided amongst the husband's children. Now, some of those children came from his daughter. Some of those children are his grandchildren. But some of those children have nothing to do with him. They are the husband's other wives and other children. They're half-brothers to the grandchildren, but they have nothing to do with this father-in-law who is giving property to his daughter. So then you have a resultant effect, which is people will be reluctant to give money in their dowries, reluctant to be generous in their dowries, which then will precipitate a secondary problem, which is that it'll be harder for the women to get married. And in our day, it's not as central or focal point of the marriage, but in their day, the economics or the financial side were central or the only thing maybe that mattered in the marriage. And therefore, if the woman does not have a strong and good dowry or financial situation, it's harder to marry her off. A woman with a good financial situation will be much easier to marry off. So now we have this tension, which is that individuals want their daughters to get married and they want to give to them. On the other hand, if they give to them, they know that that property could end up with other families and not with their own family. So Chazal came up with this solution, which is called the Ketubat Benin Dichrin, which is that after the father, or here it's the husband, passes away, then his property is divided amongst the male children. But before they divide it up amongst the male children, they allocate each ketubah to the children of that mother. So, for instance, if you have an estate that involves 600 shekel, and then you have women with ketubot that are 300, 200, and 100. So now you have these ketubot that are of different sizes. They add up to the 600 of the estate, but they're of different sizes. Before the takana, that 600 would be divided up amongst the three wives' children equally. Each group of children would get 200 shekel. Let's say there's only one son to each of these women. Then each of their sons would get 200 shekel. But that would lead to the problem that we discussed, which is the fathers-in-law, or the grandfathers in this case, would be reluctant to give the money to their daughters for exactly that reason. The one who came in with the 300 ketubah, all that money now is redistributed. His grandchildren aren't getting that money. That money is being given to the other children of the marriage. And so what we do is we set up this ketubat binin dechrin, which says, before we start allocating the assets of the estate, let's pay out the ketubot to the grandchildren. And that means that you will take the ketubah. All these women predeceased their husband. And so therefore he inherited all the money, all the ketubot were inherited by him. So the entire 600 shekel of the estate belongs to him at this point. Nevertheless, at his passing, we will go and look at the ketubot and say, the woman who had a ketubah of 300, her child will receive 300 shekel. The woman's ketubah was 200, her child will receive 200. The one who was 100, her child will receive 100. In that way, the fathers-in-law, or the grandfathers of that child, will receive the money that was given. So a wife A, who got the 300 shekel ketubah, her child will get that 300. So the grandfather or her father will now know that when he gives the money to her, its resulting impact is that it will go to his grandchild, the grandchild that came through his daughter, and not the other children of the marriage. Now, there are some caveats to this, one of which is it's only true if the assets of the estate exceed the value of the ketubot. The reason for that is that Chazal here are uprooting the Yerusha Midoraita. Yerusha Midoraita would have all the male children split the assets evenly. In doing so, they did not want to completely uproot the Din Doraita, and that means that there must be some assets in excess of the value of the ketubot. Because in that way, the remaining assets will be split according to the Doraita. So if you have 601 shekel, the 600 you'll divide up like the values of the ketubot. That one shekel that's left over, you'll divide up equally. And they'll each get a third of shekel. And therefore, the Yerusha Doraita will be accomplished with the excess amount. And the amount that added up to the ketubot will be distributed based on the ketubot. So that's one important caveat that is necessary in order for this ketubat benin dichrin to go into effect. And again, if you don't have sufficient assets, it won't matter. So you have to trust that the individual marrying here is not going to squander the assets of the marriage, because if he does do so, then the ketubat benin dichrin won't be any protection, because you won't allocate based on the ketubah, because all the assets would have been used up. So that's a important caveat to this ketubat benin dichrin. But here, the language that is used, again, we'll read through, which is the language that's absent from such a ketubah is included anyway, which is benin dichrin davin leich minai, the male children that will be born of our marriage, inun yartum kesef ketubeteich, they will then be the inheritors of the value of your ketubah, meaning that if you predecease me and I inherit your ketubah, then the children that we have together, the male children that we have together, will be the primary inheritors of your ketubah. Greater than the value of the remaining assets of the estate that will be split equally amongst the brothers, then even if you don't have it there, it's chayav to be there, because that is the Tanai Beit Din. So now, the nature of the question is, the way that ketubat benin dichrin works, you can see here is, benin dichrin davin leichuminai inun yartun, they will inherit. Well, the ketubat benin dichrin is written at the beginning of the marriage, clearly when the husband is a bari. And what you're seeing here is that the mechanism for distribution is Yerusha. That sounds exactly like Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. What you're doing here is making a promise up front to reallocate the assets of the estate in a manner by which the distribution will come out, that the ketubot will be passed to those children. So, in essence, what you're happening here is that Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka says you can allocate as you please between the male children of the marriage. That's exactly what you're doing. As you please is somewhat dictated by Beit Din over here, which is Beit Din dictates the pleasure that you will have in distributing those assets is by the level of the ketubot that were brought into the marriage. And so now you're allocating 300 to this child, 200 to this child, 100 to this child. And then excess assets will be divided evenly between the children. If that's the case, then the mechanism is Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. Yerusha is the word that's used here in the Mishnah. And this person's a bari. So what Rabbi Notan is saying to Rabbi is, you use the word yartun over here, that means you clearly think like Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. So that's his question to him. Why did you set up this Mishnah to be only according to the view of Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka? Because you used the word Yerusha. Had you used the word Matana, that'd be a different story, because everybody agrees you can allocate based on gifting any way you please. Now, the truth is that gifting has limitations, which is gifting is only retroactive, it's not prospective. So you run into a problem, and that's where maybe the Tanai Beit Din would have to come in order to ensure it. So there is reason to use Yerusha, because Yerusha makes it that it will happen at the time of death. But that can only work if the person's in power to make such decisions to reallocate at the time of death. And that's the question of Rabbi Natan. You made this Mishnah, basically, Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. So now, v'amar lo, Rabbi. Rabbi responded to Rabbi Natan of Bavli and says, Yispun Tanan. No, you're right. It really we put in there, it was gifted. The difference between Yartun, which is Yerusha, or Yisbun is gifted. So Rabbi basically says, yeah, you know what? The Mishnah should say Yispun, it shouldn't say Yartun. Va'ama Rabbi, Yaldut Haitabi. I was a young whippersnapper. I was a little arrogant. Ve'ez Asti Panai Benatana Bavli. And therefore, I answered in a impulsive manner to Rav Natan of Bavli and said, yeah, it should say Yizbun. Yartun, you're right. It doesn't have to be like Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. It could just as easily said Yizbun. Many believe that that was the girsa that was found in the Mishnah of Rabbi Natan Abavli. Natan Abavli's Mishnah had the word Yizbun in it, and not Yartun. And that's why he was questioning Rabbi about it. And Rabbi in the end says, yeah, just put in Yizbun. Once I answered him that way and said, you know what, you could just as easily put in Yizbun, or well, it'll be Yizbun. Ella, the Kaimalon, Benin Dichrin, no Tarfim, and Mishabde. Problem is that Benin Dichrin, or Kudubat Benin Dichrin, is only effective with free and clear property, not with encumbered property. And when it comes to a Ketubah, Ketubah has the right to be taken out of encumbered property. A woman has a claim to her Ketubah because her Ketubah precedes the sale to the other parties. So the date on her Ketubah is for them. If she comes to collect her Ketubah, she's a creditor whose rights precede the rights of other creditors or other buyers of the property. Her dating goes first, and therefore Ketubah takes precedence. But that's if the woman is collecting the Ketubah. Over here, the woman predeceased her husband. There is no Ketubah anymore. The Ketubah is, in its essence, ineffective because the husband inherits the wife. It's as if the Ketubah went away. The Tanai Beit Din allowed the Ketubah to still be effective in the distribution of the assets to the children. But that's all that's effective in, which is that the assets that now exist in the estate will be divided up amongst the male children based on the Ketubot of their mothers. But what you don't have a right to do then is to exercise that right of Ketubah and go and collect from other creditors, or to collect from buyers of the property of the estate prior to the death of the individual. You don't have to go a right then to go and collect from them, because the Ketubah, in essence, has no lien left in it. So now what Rabbi says is that in Benin Dichrin, or Ketubah Benin Dichrin, it only is effective, it's only meaningful with regards to the assets of the estate that are free and clear, not an encumbered property. If you made it that the Ketubah Benin Dichrin would have said gifting instead of Yerusha, then why wouldn't you have taken them away from the encumbered property? Because if the Ketubah Benin Dichrin functions as a gift, then the effective date of the gift is the time that the Ketubah is written, the time that the gift is made effective. That means that the dating of their gift preceded other creditors, preceded other buyers of the property. And if they pull out their Ketubah Benin Dichrin, they should not only be able to claim it through the free and clear property, they should be able to claim it from property that was already encumbered or taken away from the estate. The fact that they are limited to free and clear property shows you that it was not a gift, but rather Yerusha. Yerusha is only effective, or the effective date of Yerusha is at the death of the father. At that point, anything he's done before, those are rights, or those are people who have precedence before the Ketubah Benin Dichrin. So that's what Rabbi says about himself. He says, I dismissed Rabbi Natan Abavli and just said to him, instead of Yartun, write Yazbun. But the truth is, you couldn't have done that because it would have affected the din of Ketubah Benin Dichrin. And we know that Ketubah Benin Dichrin is only effective on free and clear property, not on encumbered property. By definition, that means that it's only functioning as Yerusha, not as Matana. And therefore, Rabbi backed away from his dismissal of Rabbi Natan Abavli, and he says, I shouldn't have been so quick to dismiss him. And again, Rabbi Natan Abavli is older than him, someone who has a certain amount of status and erudition. And Rabbi just said, write Yezbun. But then he realized afterwards, you couldn't have written Yezbun, you have to write Yartun, and Rabbi Natan Abavli was right. His criticism was right, which is that now you made the Mishnah only like Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. But Rabbi, in the end, has no choice because of the way that Ketubah Benin Dichrin worked. That's why he had to do it in that way. Ela Shvamina Yartun Tnan, must be that the language in the Mishnah is Yartun. And Man Shmaitle Ditle Haizvaru, who is the one who has that position? Who is the one who believes that you can reallocate the Yerusha? We only know of one person who says that that works, and that is Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. So therefore you see that Rabbi Natan Abavli is right, that Rabbi's Mishnah is supportive of that position of Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, which is no surprise, because Rabbi Paskins like Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. But the surprise is, Bishmamina afilu bibori, some people have the extra word Shmamina again, but from here you conclude that this din of Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka is equally applicable to a bari as it is to a shchid meirah. How do you see that? Because it's included in Ketubah Benin Dichrin. Ketubah Benin Dichrin is functioning through Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, and Ketubah Benin Dichrin is definitely given by someone who is a bari and not somebody who is a shchid meirah. Shchid meirah is not getting married. There are some that do, But in general, it's not a Shkem Meira that's getting married. It's somebody who's a Bari who's getting married. And he's able to allocate the assets of the estate through Yerusha, even though at the moment of his marriage, he's a Bari. So according to the Rashbam, that means that you could do it simply by articulation. According to others, it means that if you do a Kinyan and you have the proper mechanisms by a Bari, it will be just as effective as doing it as a Shkem Meira. And according to others, again, you have to structure it as Me'achshav L'achar Mita, but it would work. And Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka's din will work with a Bari, just like it works like with a Shkem Meira. As Tosfo points out over here, still, it says in the Mishnah that it is a T'nai Beitin. If it's a T'nai Beitin, then why are you saying that the mechanism for this working is Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka? In essence, it is a T'nai Beitin. So what you have to answer, and that's what the Bali Tosfo would say, is that the T'nai Beitin is just that. If you don't write it in the Ketubah, it's as if written in the Ketubah. But the T'nai Beitin is not a condition of how it works, but rather it just imposes it on you, even if you don't write it in the Ketubah. Okay, now we move on to the next section here. This leads to a major machloket in the Rishonim as to how the Gemara continues. And that has implications the halacha in the Psak halacha, which is, did the Gemara just conclude something? Or is the Gemara about to open up this question again and try to understand whether it's really true, the conclusion we came to? The conclusion we came to is that the allocation based on Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka can be done even by a Bari. That's the conclusion of the Gemara at this point. We're now going to have Rav Papa pose a question to Abaye. When Rav Papa poses the question to Abaye, does that assume that everything we've done until now is a given? That's true. Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka works by a Bari. Now Rav Papa is asking a more generic question of Abaye. This institution of Ketubat Benin Dichrin, how does it work? There's some problems that I have with the mechanism of Ketubat Benin Dichrin. That could be one way. That's the way the Rashbam views it over here. He says, the halacha is like Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka by a Bari. The only thing is, Rabbi Papa has a question of Abaye. But that does not change the conclusion that we have come to. We have assumed a conclusion, and now we have additional questions that are being asked. On the other hand, other Rishonim, including the Rashbam. Here you see Perish Rashbam Ha'ikari. Here in a couple of Dapim over here, we have the Perish Rashbam Ha'ikari, which we actually had earlier in the Masechta as well. That Perish Rashbam actually brings an alternate view that the question of Rabbi Papa on Abaye over here reopens the question in general. And similarly, you have that view in the Balei HaTosafot. And you can see that both in the Balei HaTosafot and the Rashbam Ha'ikari, that they feel that the question of Rav Papa to Abaye is continuing the previous sugya and questioning the conclusion of the sugya, the fact that Yartun must indicate or must show that Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka's din applies by a Bari. That may not be true because of the question of Rav Papa. And that's what the Rashbam Ha'ikari says. In general, it would not work. Therefore, you cannot conclude over here the halacha of Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka afilu bibari. This upends that conclusion that we saw before. Whereas the Rashbam in the Gemara that we have says, he's not going back on the question of Rava as to whether it's effective Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka by a case of ibari. Daiv Shita, because the Gemara already concluded that. Ela amai de kamar le Rabbi the Rabbi Natan. He's just questioning Rabbi's statement to Rabbi Natan. That means that when we get to the conclusion of this sugya, between Rav Papa and Abaye, it's not exactly clear how we come to a conclusion. It's not as clear as we just came to. Here we came to a definitive statement that Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka says by a Bari it works. If you think this is reopening the question, then you're left in the end with a safek. And you can't come to a conclusion about it. If you think that's conclusive, and now this question is a separate question, then the conclusion that Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka applies to a Bari is finalized. And now you're asking technical questions that we may not have answers to, or we may not be able to completely understand. Okay, so that's the two ways to read this. You can see it in the Rashbam versus the Perish Rashbam Ha'ikari. You have to just keep that in mind as we proceed now with the Gemara. So now, Rav Papa asks of Abaye, Amrle Rav Papa Abaye, Ben Laman Damar Yazbun, Ben Laman Damar Yartun, irrespective of what language you use here, Ha, ein adam makne davar shelo b'olei olam. A person can't grant something or give something that does not yet exist. And again, some say that this is a question on the whole premise of what we said before, and this reopens the can of worms about whether a bari can gift through like Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. Others, like the Rishbam, say simply, he's asking a question. How does it work? You're trying to gift something that does not exist yet. Because the way the Ketubah B'din Nichrin goes, it looks at the assets of the estate at the time of death. The time that the Ketubah is written, who says those assets exist? First of all, he could acquire many assets along the way. He could sell assets, buy assets. Things could change in the estate between the time that the Ketubah is written and the time of the Yerusha. That means that in essence, he is now granting them ownership, granting them rights in property that shelo b'alei olam. And Akilu, the Rabbi Meir, even according to Rabbi Meir, Damar, Adam makne davar shelo b'alei olam, even according to Rabbi Meir, who says you have a right to do such, to grant ownership in items that have yet to come into the world, hani milei ledavar sheyeshno b'olam. That's only true if the acquirer of the property exists. Aval the davar sheinu b'olam, to give it or grant the right to someone who does yet to exist, lo, you can't do that. The kids clearly don't exist because he's just getting married now. Right, hopefully the kids don't exist yet when he's getting married. But the Ketubat Benin Dichrin that is done over here is to give the kids in the future who will be born of this marriage rights in future assets. So even if you're able to overcome the problem of future assets by saying, oh, it's Rabbi Meir, you still can't overcome the problem that the recipients of the gift don't exist yet. And therefore, even Rabbi Meir believes you can't be makneh that item. So that is Rav Papa's question. And he says, I don't really understand how this is working. Ella, t'nai beitin shiny. It is because it is a condition of beitin. Hachanami, t'nai beitin shiny. Just like a t'nai beitin over here changes the allocation of the distribution, so over here, the Tanai Beit Din overcomes the deficit of Davar Shelo B'alei Olam, or also people who are not in the world yet. The Tanai Beit Din is able to overcome this, as all the Rishonim point out over here, that the Olim Tanai Beit Din Mishum Hefker, Beit Din Hefker. The Beit Din has a right to disown you of your property, and that's exactly what they're going to do. At the time of the death of the individual, they're going to disown him from a percentage of the assets of his estate, enough to make up all the Ketubat Benin Dichrin, and it'll be given to them. Depending on how you read this Gemara, that will then matter what was just said. If you think Rav Papa was asking Abaye, how can you conclude that this is Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, that is not the mechanism of distribution over here. The mechanism of distribution over here is not Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka and Yerusha, it is Tanai Beit Din. And I can prove you that's Tanai Beit Din, because without Tanai Beit Din, this whole thing won't work. Because you have the problem of Davar Shelo B'Olam and Davar She'eino B'Olam. You have two problems. The object's not in the world, and neither is the recipient in the world. So it's clearly functioning through Tanai Beit Din. Once you assume it's functioning through Tanai Beit Din, then that must be that the same way that Tanai Beit Din allows for the reallocation because of Hefker Beit Din Hefker, it allows to overcome these problems. But that means that it's not Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. It is Tanai Beit Din. So that could be one way to read it, which is that Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka is not relevant here at all. And that's Rav Papa's question to Abaye, and it's a continuation of the previous Gemara. The way that the Rishbam reads it is not that this is a question of Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. That we assume is correct. The question is, still, even if you use Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka and you say that it's Yerusha, you still have to overcome other problems. How do you overcome those problems? The answer is Tanai Beit Din. V'achikamer, lamalei Rabbi, the Meimer, Rabbi Tatan, Yasbun Tanan. Lugbe Matit and the Divrei HaKol. Why does he have to go to the word Yazbun in order for this Mishnah to be according to everyone? Even if you use the Lashon of Yartun, it could be according to everyone. Because Ben the Mandamar Yazbun, Ben the Mandamar Yartun, you have a question here of Davar Shelo B'alei Olam, and the only solution to that problem is Tanai Beit Din. Since that's the only solution to the problem, then Tanai Beit Din overcomes whatever deficits that you have here, whether you use the Lashon Yartun or Yazbun. And therefore, the use of the Lashon of Yartun could be even according to the Chachamim. You don't have to go to a language of Yazbun. All right, so that's the other way to read it. Again, that the way that the Rashbam reads it is that it's not a question on the fundamental course. It's just a question on how we deal with the trappings of this passing of the Ketubah B'nin Dichrin, whereas in the Rashbam, Perish Rishbam Yikri, he says, Miu, lo ayalem ladun din l'taken t'nai shalem l'fi divrei Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. If it's a t'nai beit din, why does it have to follow the view of Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka? Well, haskir l'shon l'yartun b'tnai shalem. So why do they have to mention yartun? Just put in yazbun. Ah, you said you have the problem of tarfei mimishabdei. There is another reason. There's an alternate reason for putting in the word yartun and not yazbun, which is the timing of the rites. So he says, listen, if the whole thing is working as a t'nai beit din anyway, let the t'nai beit din say that even though it uses a language of yazbun, it's only effective from the date of the death, and therefore they will not be able to take from mishabdei. And so his point is, once you're entering into the world of t'nai beit din, you have a lot of flexibility about how to deal with this, and therefore you don't have to say it, or you don't have to prove that it is like Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. The use of the word yartun seems strange, or it seems difficult to attribute that to Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, because you can explain everything here as being, for instance, yazbun. And even though it's yazbun, you wouldn't take it from mishabdei. You would only take it from those things that are free and clear, because that is the t'nai beit din. And therefore, Rabbi was correct in answering Rabbi Natan Abavli that yazbun, we wrote yazbun, because it has nothing to do with Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. So that's the challenge of Rapapa to Abaye. And now he answers him, Amalei, mishum demakvik lei b'lashon yartun. Because it uses the Lashon Yartun. According to the Rashbam HaIkari, the answer of Abaye to Rapapa is this. The Lo Shani Hocha Mishar T'naim De'alma. It's no different than any other condition. Mishum, the Kamapik Lashon Yartun Kamaknilu, Afabi Shalom Baudulam, Dakshav Lo Maknilu Mide. The reason being is because at this moment, he's not giving them anything. Elhechik Amar, Banim Asher Yulduli, Hem Yerushun Nechsai L'Kesheamut. They will inherit my property when I pass away. Kshimut Kvar Yeshnam Ba'olam. When I pass away, they are going to be in the world. V'ayishat Ahud Ati. And at that moment is when the transaction or the transference of ownership happens. V'lagach Hashum Shinoi V'chidush Yoter Mishar T'naim. It's no different than any other condition that you would put in a contract, that it requires some sort of future item or trigger to happen. So it's over here. This t'nai is in the future, and the t'nai in the future will allow the transference of ownership, because at that point, that t'nai will be affected, because both the assets and the individuals will be in the world. There'll be yeshno bo'olam, and at that moment, the transaction will go effective. And that's the answer that the Abaye is giving to Rapapa, is you're wrong. This isn't a problem of davar sheino bali olam, and not the problem of davar sheyeshno bo'olam. None of those are relevant over here, because the use of the Urim Tartun says it's not effective today, rather only effective later on when all of those issues are surmounted. And you can see that at the end of the Tosafot on the Kuf Lamed Aleph Amud Aleph, where he quotes the Rashbam as saying such, which is interesting because the Tosafot's quote comes out of the Rashbam HaIkari and not out of the Rashbam that we have. And then he says, Vein Nira, he thinks that's not the right way to explain this. Whereas the Tosafot and others just simply say that the use of the word Yartun is indicative of the halacha like being like Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. Because already, if you're going to invoke a t'nai beit din in order for this to be effective, you want to minimize the chidushim that you're using over here. So if you have to say yazbun or yartun, and only the language of yazbun is effective and yartun is not effective, because Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka doesn't apply by a bari, why would the t'nai beit din include a language that requires a t'nai beit din to overcome that language in and of itself? Had you written yazbun and then made it a t'nai beit din, it would have worked just fine. So why then use the word yartun? Elaim Tain, you believe that yartun also works. If yartun works, then it makes sense that the t'nai beit din is set up with it, because then you have the advantage of the word yartun teaching you that they do not take from encumbered property, only from free and clear property. It's effective as a kinyan, because Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka applies even by a bari. And the t'nai beit din overcomes the other deficits of a davar sheino bali olam or davar sheyeshno bo'olam. Whereas if you believed that Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka's din does not apply to a bari, then using the words yartun means that the t'nai beit din is not only overcoming the deficits of davar sheino bali olam, it's also have to overcome the deficit of the language that you use. So then we would prefer you use yazbun. Ah, the problem that if you use yazbun, that you only take it from b'nei b'chorim. Either you could state that yasbin mi b'nei chorin, you could state it explicitly, or that could be a part of the t'nai beit din. But the fact that you use the Lashon of Yartun in and of itself is indicative of the fact that it must be the Halacha like Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. So that's how other Rishonim learn, as opposed to the Perush Rashbam Ha'Ikari over here. The fact that they use the Lashon of Yartun shows you that it's still like Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. Hadar Amar Baye, Lav Miltihi Damre. What I said is incorrect. Ditznan, Lo Katav La Bnan Nukhvan, Davin Laichi Minai, This is another one of the Tnae Beitin, another one of the Tnae Ketubah, which is these are institutions of the court in Kerem B'Yavne. It's after the Sanhedrin Gadol moved from the Mikdash after Churban Habayit to Kerem B'Yavne. Over there, they instituted these takanot with regards to the Ketubot. One of them was Ketubah Benin Dikrin. The other one is the Banot, that the Banot are Nizonot. The Banot are given the right to take Mizonot out of the estate as long as they are not married. And that's what it has been here. Banan Nukvan Davin Laichi Minai, the female children that we bear together, Yavin Yatfin Bebeiti, they will remain in my house, meaning in the estate, Vitzan Minichsai, and they will have right to Mizonot from the estate, Ati Lakach Neguvrin, until they are married off to other men who will then take care of them, and they won't need Mizonot from the estate. So even though that is not written in the Ketubah, nevertheless, Chayav, Shehu Tnai Beitin. That's an obligation because it is a Tnai Beitin. Vavi lezebe matana, ulezebe yirusha. If that's the case, then in the Ketubah, you've included two institutions. One institution that works through gifting, and one institution that works through Yerusha. We had before in the Gemara, that if a person in the mechanism of Yerusha uses the word matana anywhere in the document, that makes it into a gift, and it will work even though you mentioned Yerusha there. And that is, we said, the zebe matana, the zebe Yerusha. Remember, 2 days ago in the daf, we said that if in the same document you gave one person a gift, and you gave one person a Yerusha, v'chol the zebe Yerusha, the zebe matana, afil rabbanan modu. Even the Rabbanan are Moda, then in that case it works. That even in that case, that Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka's din applies, because we say that the Lashon Matana is applied to all the parties there, even though it was used by only one of the parties. Now, if you look at the two different languages that we had, by the case of the Tubat Benin Dichrin, the language was Yartun, Yerusha. But by the case of the daughters who get Mizonot out of the estate, there's no word of Yerusha over there. This is a granting of a gift. This is a matana. This is the equivalent of Yezbon for the daughters. There's no word Yerusha mentioned in that at all. And obviously they're not working like Yerusha because they're getting Mizonot. But that means that in the document that we said before, or in any transaction that involves two parties, and there the Gemara 2 days ago discussed whether it was two parties, two sadot, one party, two sadot, but we said you're able to attribute the verb used to one party to the other party. So over here in the Ketubah is included both language of Matana and language of Yerusha. And what Abaye points out is once you have that, even the Rabbonon agree in that case that you're able to reallocate the assets because we assume that the word Matana applies to all the parties in the Ketubah. So what Abaye says is, listen, Rapapa, you might have been right that this is all it's Tnai Beitin. But even if it is a Tnai Beitin, why did Rabbi go out of his way to use the word Yartun? Must be because he believes, like Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. That was Rabbi's answer to Rapapa. Despite all of your fancy footwork to say it's a Tnai Beitin, in the end he used the language of Yartun. And the etch should govern over here to tell you that he holds like Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. Because otherwise he should have just used whatever language it was, Yazbon, and then Beitin could have made up whatever the rules are, and no Tarfi Mishab. The fact that he used the word Yartun is proof positive that he believes Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. But he thinks afterwards and says, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe even the Rabbanan in this case agree. Because the Ketubah contains language of Matana and language of Yerusha. And in that instance, even the Chachamim agree that you can allocate. And that means that that word Yartun before is not governing, because it's governed by the Matana, by the daughters. And therefore, even the Rabbanan would agree here. So even if you use the word Yartun, that doesn't indicate that it's Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. It might even be the Rabbanan that are agreeing in this case, because now you have a Matana and a Yerusha found in the same document. So they challenged Abaye from this. Mimai, Debechad Beidina Itkin. How do you know that these two takanot came or derived from the same Beitin? You're assuming that they are both together, that there's a matana and a Yerusha together. That assumes that they were instituted at the same time. If they were instituted at different times, then they're not technically in the same document. It could be that the word Yartun was put in the document when the matana was never in the document. If that's the case, then Yartun has meaning because it's not governed by the matana part. Your assumption is that these two different takanot entered the ketubah at the same time, or they were instituted by the same beitin at the same time. How do you know that? Dilma betray beidina itkun. Maybe they were done in two different batei dinim. As the Rashbam points out in the previous amud, he says that if they were instituted in the same beitin, then v'alchashtei takanot alo kevin de bat achat tiknu. If they were together instituted, havei kemo toch kdei dibor. The equivalent of them being said within a toch kdei dibor, which we saw again two daf ago with regards to different languages that are included, or different statements that are made, how do they affect each other? If they're in Toch Kedei Dibor, they're all considered to be one package, and the verb matana affects all of that which is there, and even the Rabbanim would agree. So what the Rishvam points out is, if you believe they were instituted by the same Batei Dinim, then it's as if they were said Toch Kedei Dibor, and the language matana will affect the Yerusha. But that's a big assumption. Well, that's what they're asking about you. How do you know you're right about that? How do you know that these two takanot have anything to do with each other? He says, Lo salkadatcha, you would not believe that they were instituted in two different batei dinim, diktani reisha, because over there you have a Tanaic explanation for the connection between these two takanot. Zem midrash derash Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah lefnei chachamim bekerem biyavne. This is Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah explained to the chachamim, or was doresh to the chachamim in Yavne, habanim yirshu, vabonot izonu. These are the two different aspects. The sons inherit, the daughters do not inherit, but they get mizonot out of the estate. Ma banim eni yoshim ela lachar mitat abiyem. Just like sons do not inherit except at the death of their father, meaning once the person who's bequeathing to them passes away, afbanot lo yizonu ela lachar mitat abiyem. So too, the daughters are only entitled to mizonot after the death of the father. Over there, the discussion is the obligation of a parent to give mizanot to their children. And what Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah proves is that there's no obligation on a father to be nizon, to sustain his children, because the ketubah only obligates him to pay for the mizanot of the girls after his death. Prior to his death, there is no obligation. That's what he proves. But the way he proves it is because just like the boys inherit after the death of their father, so too, the mizanot of the daughters are only applicable after the death of the father. If you believe these two takanot were instituted in the same beitin, that's how Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah extrapolated from one takana to the other takana. It says, just like the takana of ketubat benin dichrin only applies at the death of the father, so too the takana of the daughters only applies at the death of the father, and the obligation of the father's estate to sustain the children exists, but there's no obligation on the father himself to support his children. The Gemara in Ketubot that discusses it says it's only by pi'utot, very young children who depend on him, he has to sustain. Above that age, like maybe above the age of 6 or 7, the parent no longer has any obligation to support the children, and they have to fend for themselves. Now, the Gemara has institutions over there that require a parent to still sustain their child until 12. There's an additional takanah derabanan in Usha that says parents must support the children until the age of 12. But after the age of 12, they're on their own. Again, we spoke at that time about the tshuvot that are written as to whether in our time that's different. That if you put children into position when they're unable to support themselves, maybe they have the same din as pe'utot, or maybe they have the same din as being below the age of 12. Since we keep children in schooling for a much longer period of time and they don't have the capacity to support themselves, that maybe there's an obligation on the parent to support the child for a longer duration. And that is apparent in many of the tshuvot that you find in the modern tshuvot about the changing of that timing. Again, it's not our topic. That's for the Gemara and Ketubot. But here, at least, what you see is that there is an overlapping of the takanot because Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah is using one takana to extrapolate to another takana. That would only be possible if the two takanot were instituted by the same beitin. Because then you could argue that that Beit Din, when it put them together, had the same thing in mind. But if you're saying that they have two different bate dinim, how can you say what's applicable by one takana is also applicable by the other takana? You have no idea that Beit Din put this takana in place wasn't thinking about the other takana. If that's the case, Abai says they were clearly instituted by the same Beit Din. That's what he says. Yamar bishlam abachad Beit Dino itkun haynu diyafin and takana mi takana. Ela yamar bitray Beit Dino itkun. If you believe that they were really instituted in two bate dinim, echa yavin and takana mi takana. How can you learn one takana from another takana? Mimai, maybe that's not right for Abaye, the Gemara says. Doma, the Olam Emelecha betrayed Bate Beidina Itkun. That it was instituted in two different Bate Dinim. Ve Beidina Be Batra, Tikun Ke Beidina Kama. The latter Beit Din, who instituted the latter Takana, was premising it, or relying, or leaning on the original Takana. Keichi lo tiksha takanta takanta. In order to keep the Takanot consistent. Because if you didn't do that, what you'd end up having is a patchwork tuba. You'd have a tuba that has one takana that does this, and functions like this way. And you have another takana that functions a different way. Which is, one takana says you gotta feed the girls starting from the time of their marriage, the time of their birth. And you have another takana that says the boys only get their tuba bindikran after the death of the father. So now the tuba will be a patchwork of these ideas. So all we're saying is that the institution of the mizunot habanot, even if it was done by a different Beit Din, was paralleled after the paradigm of the Benin Dichrin. And therefore, even though it was instituted in two Debate Dinim, nevertheless, the latter Beit Din went ahead and formulated it based on the earlier Beit Din, and that's what Rav Eliezer ben Azariah is saying. Even if you want to say it's in two Debate Dinim, still, you could argue that there's something that connects them, which is the commonality of them being placed in the ketubah. Whatever you could learn, just like the institution of ketubah benin dichrin is only after the death of the father, so too the mizanot to the banot is only after the death of the father. But that would present a problem for Abaye, which is that if it was two bate dinim, you can't argue that one is a lashon matana, one's a lashon yerusha, and that when they're put together, then it's considered as if everything is a matana, because that's not true. The institution of the ketubah benin dichrin was done before, not at the same time as the ketubah, as the mizonot habanot. That means that that institution of yartun was put into the ketubah at a time where there was no lashon matana in the ketubah. And that means that's like Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, because that means working like Yerusha and not like matana. So that would be the conclusion here. Now, there are three ways to conclude this Gemara. One way to conclude the Gemara is if you believe that Rabbah's challenge to Abaye was, how could it be that you're concluding like Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, this is all a Tanai Beit Din? Abaye says, no, it's not a Tanai Beit Din, because if it was a Tanai Beit Din, you could have written whatever language. The fact that Rabbi in the Mishnah used the language of Yartun is indicative that it's functioning like Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. So that's the solution now that Abaye gives to Rav Papa. Then Abaye undermines his own solution by saying, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe the reason that Yartun over here doesn't matter is because you have Matana and Yerusha and the Ketubah. It's all overridden. The Gemara then comes back and says, no, Abaye, you're wrong. They don't have to be instituted together. Since they don't have to be instituted together, then you can't argue that the word Yartun is meaningless there because it has Matana in the same document. Maybe there were two different institutions and the word Yartun does have meaning. But now if the word Yartun has meaning, then you've concluded again that the Locha is like Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. So that's one way to conclude the Gemara. And you can see that in the Rashbam, Ma'ikari, where he says, Olam, Ben Bibari, Ben Mishchimera, Mehani, Lashon Yerusha. He sees this as being the final stage in the discussion over here. And the fact that Abaye took away the question that he asked on his answer to Rav Papa means that his answer to Rav Papa was valid. And if his answer to Rav Papa is valid, then he has now gone back to the original state of saying that Yerusha and distribution, according to Rabbi Yochanan Baroka, works even by a bari. And you can see a similar conclusion in the Rabbeinu Gershom, Nololam Rabbi Yochanan Baroka, Velo Rabbanon. Again, that would mean simply that the question of a papa was answered by Abaye, which is the language of Yartun governs over here, and Yartun is only applicable by Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, and the reason they use Yartun makes it only like Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, because I can't explain it according to the Chachamim. That's one conclusion you could come to. The other possible conclusion you could come to is that before we already concluded that the Mishnah is like Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, how do we deal with Rav Papa's question of Davar Shelo Ba'di Olam? That's dealt with the issue of Tanai Beit Din. So now that you have Tanai Beit Din over there, then what is this talk about Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka? The answer is Yartun. They use the language of Yartun. And that language is what makes it like Rabbi Yochanan ben Brokos, Tolo Tarfim and Mishabdeh. And then Rabbi Abaye tried to then undermine his own answer. In the end, the Gemara says, no, Abaye's answer is good. And that is that even though there is a Tanai Beit Din, there still is this Yartun that's included in the language. Last way to possibly learn the Gemara here is that this answer of the Gemara is not definitive. We don't know whether it was instituted in two Bate Dinim or one Beit Din. All the Gemara proved is that you don't have to say that it was instituted in one Beit Din. But it is possible that it was instituted in one Beit Din. And therefore, the Gemara is actually inconclusive over here. So now, if the Gemara is inconclusive, it depends on what you thought was going on with Rav Papa and Abaye. If you thought that we already concluded Rabbi Yochanan ben Brokos is definitely the author of the Mishnah, then Rav Papa is just asking about the mechanism that's used here of Tanai Beit Din, then in the end, if you come to an inconclusive here with regards to Abaye, that doesn't undermine or change the fact that we already concluded that Rabbi Yochanan ben Brokos works by a Bari. That's a given. Now, you want to deal with the issue of the language and the Tanai Beit Din. That's something that we can't conclude about because we don't know if it's instituted in one Beit Din or in two Bate Dinim. Since we don't know, the original halacha that's like Rabbi Yochanan ben Brokos stands, and this we leave unresolved with regards to Abaye and Rav Papa's discussion. Or, if you believe that Rav Papa's question to Abaye continued the discussion from before and does not conclude that halacha is like Rabbi Yochanan ben Brokos by Abari, then the inconclusiveness of the Gemara over here, which says that it could have gone one way like the Chachamim and one way like Rabbi Yochanan ben Brokos, would also mean that it's inconclusive about that solution as to whether Rabbi Yochanan ben Brokos applies by a Bari. Those are the different ways that the Gemara concludes, depending on how you read this section of the Gemara, and as obviously has influence on how you would pass an halacha, whether halacha is like Rabbi Yochanan ben Brokos by a Bari, or not like him by a Bari. Right now, the Gemara moves on to a different topic, somewhat connected, but slightly different topic. I'm Rabbi Yehuda Amar Shmuel. Hakotev kol nechasav li'ishto, lo asa el apitropo. This is something that we saw in the Rashbam already yesterday, that there is this rule, which is not a halachic rule, but rather a rule of intentions. And later on in the Gemara, it's actually going to tell us that this halacha is one of those halachot that the Chachamim instituted, a halacha below tam. It's not something that's necessarily logical. It's not something that necessarily you can empirically say that this is what they meant. Nevertheless, the Chachamim believed that this was the best outcome in such a situation, and therefore they instituted that this would be the din. When we are carrying out the last will and testament of the individual, we are trying to abide by what he is saying, but in a manner that carries out what he said by offending the least number of people or upsetting the situation in the least way possible. And that is, if someone gifts all of his assets to his wife, lo asa ele apitropa, he only made her into an executor of the estate. And it's important to note over here the mention of kol nechasav, all of his property, because we only assume that this was done derech kavod or to make them into an executor when it was 100% of the assets that were granted to them. But it's less than 100% of the assets, and it's clear you're not making them into an executor, you're making them into an owner, because otherwise you would have given them control of all the assets. The fact that now you're allocating assets means you really meant for them to own the assets and not become an executor. As Rashbam pointed out earlier, when you use a lashon matana, a gift can be given in two different ways. A gift can be manifest in ownership of the item that you're giving. A gift can also be a gift not in that you own it, but that you control it. That you're the one who allocates, you're the one who distributes those assets, and you are given that controlling interest. That is the gift that you are being given. And the reason being is because the one who's in control of the assets, the people who are dependent on them for the distribution of those assets, will afford them a certain amount of kavod or respect associated with that. So that's why the Rashbam reads this whole Gemara, which is, if we know that the husband would want that his wife is respected by the children of the marriage, then what he will do is put all the possessions in the hand of his wife. In doing so, she will be the executor of the estate, not the owner of the estate, but then the children who receive the allocations from the estate will have to treat the mother in a proper manner. So that's the statement over here that Akutev kol nechasav l'ishto, we assume that he didn't really gift all his assets to his wife. He wouldn't disinherit all the other parties here, but rather he is simply making her into the executor of the estate. And therefore, the children now, who are the recipients of the estate, will have to now give kavod to this individual. Now, this ishto, his wife, could be both their mother, in which case they would have obligations d'oraita to afford her kavod, but it also could be that she is a stepmother to them. Now, a stepmother do have an obligation to give kavod to the stepmother, but that's because of eshet av, because she is the wife of your father. And as the wife of your father, that obligation really is two things. Only a derivative of kavod for your father. And number two, might be only applicable while your father is alive. Because then she's eshet av. But after the death of the father, she's now a quote-unquote foreigner, a nachriya to you. She's not the mother of the individual. She's not your father's wife anymore because the father passed away. And therefore, maybe there's no obligation of kavod. But knowing that, at least, min haTorah, there is a certain amount of obligation towards one's mother of kavod, as well as towards eshet av, therefore we could understand why a husband would gift all the property to his wife, not in ownership, but to be the executor in order to facilitate kavod being given to that woman. Pshita. Now the Gemara goes on and gives a list of items. Bino hagadol lo aso ele bitropus. If a person grants all the property of the estate to his eldest son, then he didn't really mean to give all the property of the estate to the eldest son, but rather that he be the executor of the estate. Now here, Bino HaGadol is the Bechor. The Bechor, as the eldest child, is deserving of kavod from his brothers. That we have from the Ribui and the Pasuk by Kibud Aveim. He said, Et, the Rabot, et Achiv HaGadol, to include his older brother. The older brother thereby is deserving of a certain amount of respect. Therefore, we're going to interpret the gift of all the assets of the estate to this eldest son as not being what he wanted to happen, but rather just an indication that he wants the other brothers, or his children, to treat this Bino HaGadol with respect. How does he engender that? It gives him the right to be the executor of the estate, and therefore we would read the allocation of all the assets of the estate to this particular child as making him into an executor and not as being true ownership. Bino HaKatan Mai. What happens if he granted all the ownership of the assets to a younger child? Not to the Bechor. To one of the children. So now, Itmar Rav Chanilai Bar Idi HaMeshmuel, Afilu Bino HaKatan HaMutal BeErisa. Even if he has a child who is in the crib still, not granting him the rights of ownership, but simply the rights to be the executor of the estate. So far the conclusion of the Gemara is, they gift all the assets to the wife, then she's really the executor of the estate, not the owner of the estate. You gift all the property to the eldest son, he's also only executor of the estate, not the owner of the estate. What about another child? The Gemara over here concludes, even when it comes to another child, we assume that the father wanted to put that child as the central person and to have him be afforded that kavod. And therefore, his allocation of the assets wasn't an allocation of ownership, simply an allocation to make him into the executor of the estate. Now, over here, you have a fundamental problem, which is, until now, Rabbi had the din of Rabbi Yochanan ben Brocha. The din of Rabbi Yochanan ben Brocha says you can allocate your assets as you please to the children that are the rightful heirs. Over here, when he gives it to his Bino HaGadol, or if he gives it to Bino HaKatan, he has a right to do that under Rabbi Yochanan ben Brocha. Why is the Gemara all of a sudden saying, oh, it's not real Yerusha, but rather it is making him into the executor of the estate? Why can't it be Yerusha? Rabbi Yochanan ben Brocha allows you to make it into Yerusha over here. So many answer that the difference over here is HaKotev. Over here, it's being written down. It's one thing if the Shechiv Meirah allocates the properties by simply articulating that he wants the property to go to so-and-so and so-and-so. A Shechiv Meirah does not need to have it written down. So that's why the Rabbeinu Chananel differentiates and says that over here, we're talking about Ktiva. Over there, we're speaking about articulation. And the reason we're saying this is because the Shechiv Meirah did not need to write it down. The fact that he went out of his way to write down something that didn't need to be written down makes us want to reinterpret it and say that he must have done it for a reason. He must have wanted it that became publicized, that this individual is the executor of the estate, thereby granting that individual kavod. The kavod comes from two aspects. One is those that need him to allocate the estate to them will have to give him kavod. But also the kavod will come from the fact that he is the executor of the estate. People know that. That also gives him a certain amount of kavod or standing. And so that's what is going on here because of the difference between kotev kol nechasav versus articulation. The other possibility is that Rabbi Yochanan ben Brocha's din only applies when you explicitly use the language of hakna'ah, of ownership. Over here, where he doesn't use any language that indicates ownership, but rather some generic statement, that's where the Chachamim say we reinterpret his words to mean that he's appointing them the executor of the estate and not granting them full ownership rights. Whereas the Rashbam, not here, but the Rashbam back on Kuf Lamed Amud Aleph, which we mentioned yesterday, is that in the case of Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, he used the Lashon of Yerusha. And since they use the Lashon of Yerusha, it doesn't matter if he articulated it or wrote it down, it is effective. Whereas over here, by us, it's using a Lashon Matana. And therefore, when he writes it down or uses a Lashon Matana, that can be reinterpreted to mean both items. That can be reinterpreted to mean executor, or it can be interpreted to mean a gifting of the actual rights of the property. And therefore, there's a difference between Lashon Yerusha and Lashon Matana, and that explains the difference between Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka's din until now, which was Yerusha, and the din we're speaking about here, which is a Lashon of Matana. That's what he says back on Kuf Lamed Amud Aleph, Hani Mile Kotev Lashon Matana Omer Lashon Matana Dichvodo Ikavein Laknogo Nechasav. Aval Lashon Yerusha Kana Kol Kegdin Torah Kenafkalam Biyomin Chiloet Benav. Because the Lashon Matana Ika LeMeimar Dehikne Lo Kol Nechasim, but also the possibility that he gave it to them as an apitropo. But when it comes to Yerusha, there's only one way to interpret the word Yerusha. Now we mentioned before, which is that you step into the shoes of the bequeather and you become like the bequeather, which means literal Yerusha. All right, so now that's the conclusion of this point. Then Itmar, and now we have Pshito. We know that Bno V'Acher, when you have to deal with his child and another party, Acher B'Matana, Ubno Apitropus. This line in the Gemara is difficult, and there are two Gusaot that are over here as to what happened. Is the story that he gave his assets away and split them 50-50 between his son and a third party? That's one way to read what just said by the Gemara. Or, the other way to read the Gemara, and this is the way that the Rashbam favors, is Peshita Bno V'Acher. If you give 100% to your child, or you give 100% to a third party, we know what the outcome is. So reading it like the Rashbam, if you grant 100% of the assets to a child, then we know that Bno Apitropus, that the child is made into an executor. We just saw that before. We saw that if you give it to the oldest child, or even another child, even a baby in the crib, you still are making them into an executor, not really giving away the assets. On the other hand, if you give 100% of your assets to a third party, it's clear there that you're giving it as a gift. Because why else would you give it to a third party? You're not giving it to a third party to give him kavod, because there's no obligation of kavod vis-a-vis that third party. Since there's no obligation of kavod, why would the person try to engender kavod when there's no necessity for kavod? It must be then if you give 100% of your assets to that individual, then it's given to them as a gift and not as an executor of the estate. That's the way to read it that the Rashbam does. But the other possibility, again, as we said, was that the Rashbam rejects this language, that Bno V'Acher means that they split it 50-50. So what the Gemara is saying here is when the Ben and the Acher split it 50-50, it's clear to us that the Acher got his property and he walks off with it. That's what he does. The 50% that's given to the son is 100% of what's left of the estate. That means that we go back to the din that we had before, which is when you give all of your property to one child, he is an executor on behalf of the other children. And that's what the Gemara is saying over here. You gave away 50% to a third party, and now you gave the remaining 50% to this one child. Now this one child got 100% of the estate that was available to the children. So then we say in that case, he is an executor for the other children, and he's not the sole inheritor of the estate. So that's the alternate way to read this, which is that when you have a split of the estate, as long as 100% of what was left for the children went to our particular child, we assume that he is being made into an executor and not made into a yoresh, or the acquirer of all those properties. So that's the other way to read it. And there's a third interpretation that's brought by the Haggah and the Rashbam over here, which is that it's a case where the Acher is someone who has the right to inherit the inheritor over here. Which is, for instance, it's a son and a grandson. For instance, a case where there are two parties that inherit him, but they come from different levels. Which is, for instance, a case where his son is inheriting him, as well as his grandson, meaning the nephew of the son that is inheriting. His brother passed away, and therefore his nephew becomes the heir. Equivalent of Bnot Slavchad, who are then made as peers to the brothers of Slavchad. So in that case, if he grants 100% of the ownership to his son, we assume he does that to make him into the executor for himself as well as his nephew. On the other hand, if he grants 100% to his nephew, who's the acher over here, even though he's a rightful heir, over there we don't say that he wants his son to give kavod to his nephew. Therefore, we assume that the acher is getting as a matana, and it's 100% of a gift, and not to engender kavod. Ishto arusa, bishto grusha v'matana. And this is what kind of forces the Rashbam's hand in saying that this is speaking about a case where you're giving 100% to each of the parties, and not 50% to each party. Because ishto arusa, ishto grusha, it's clear there that he's not giving it to them to be executors of the estate, because in neither of those cases does he have a reason to have them be given kavod. If it's his wife that he divorced already, it's clear that he doesn't need to give her kavod or engender kavod towards her, because they are divorced. Ishto arusa is still early on in the marriage. It's before he even had nisuin with her. And therefore, again there's no reason for him to engender any sense of kavod towards her. And therefore, we believe when he grants ownership to the arusa, or he grants ownership of the estate, or a portion of the estate to the gerusha, he's clearly doing that as a matana, and not as an apitropos, not as an executor of the estate, because there's no reason for him to make them into executors, to have them be given kavod, given that his relationship with them is not a relationship that would require the engendering of such kavod. Ibailo, so now here's the question. Bat etzel banim, v'isha etzel achim. If you have allocations where a daughter gets the assets when there are male children, or the woman, the wife, gets assets when the brothers are the inheritors. So here we've changed the dynamic a little bit, which is, here you have a daughter that is in getting all the assets, 100% of the assets, even though the banim are the rightful heirs to the property. So now, does that allocation to the bat mean that he gave her 100% of the ownership? Or is that allocation to the bat because he wants the boys to give respect to the daughter? And as the Rashbam points out, we do have such a paradigm. When it comes to the assets of the estate, we say that if there are limited assets in the estate, the boys have to go around and beg for mizonot, and the daughters get mizonot out of the estate. So you see that we do give deference to the daughters in face of sons in some cases. So do we say that's the same thing over here? The father wanted to engender that deference by giving the daughter 100% of the assets, not for her to own, but to be the executor. Or do we say that the case by banim and banot over there, by mizonot, has nothing to do with kavod towards the daughters versus the sons, but has to do with what is considered to be proper in society? It's not proper for a daughter to go out and beg door to door. It's nothing to do with her relationship to her brothers. It has to do with her independent standing in society, and therefore we want to protect her versus the brothers, not because the brothers owe her any kavod. So those are the two sides to the story. Isha etzel achim again. Over there you have no obligation. The brothers-in-law have no obligation to give respect or kavod to their brother's wife. There's no reason that they have to, and there's no reason that he would want to engender it. So in that case, when you have an isha that was given all the 100% of the assets, and the Yorshim are the brothers, meaning that this individual passed away, he has no children, and his father already passed away. So the only people available now to inherit him are his brothers. And then he gave the 100% allocation to his wife. What happens then? This is what we discussed before. By Isha, it makes sense when you're talking about Ishto, his wife, who's also the mother of the children. In that case, you want to engender kavod. But what happens if you have a stepmother by a bnei abal? A stepmother by the children of the husband, meaning that they're not her children from another wife, and therefore she is a stepmother. So if he grants 100% of the assets to this woman, is that because he's giving it to her as a matana? Or is that because he wants to engender kavod, that the stepchildren give kavod to their stepmother? As we discussed before, there is such a concept because of etavicha, the rabot and eshet aviv, that comes to include even your father's wife that you have to give respect to. But that all derives from the father himself, not inherently that there's a need for kavod in that case. Therefore, when the father passed away, maybe that's dissolved. And therefore, you have the same question over here. Is it been given to the stepmother because it's hers? It's been given to the stepmother because they will engender kavod being given to her by the stepchildren. Mao, what's the din in all of these three cases? Amravina mishmei derava bekulo lo kana. In all these cases, there's no kinyan. The bar mi ishto arusa v'ishto grusha. When it comes to Ishto Arusa, Ishto Grusha, there it's clear that you're giving it as a matana, because there's no reason for kavod. There it's absolutely obvious. But in the other cases, we say that even though it's not as obvious, there's still a semblance of kavod that exists in these cases. And therefore we assume that when he gifted it as a kavod mechanism, and therefore they are executors of the estate and not the inheritors of the property. He is acquiring all of them, and it works. In all these cases, they do get it as a gift and keep it. The bar misha itzel achim, v'isha itzel b'nei abal. With the exception of a woman with the brothers, meaning that the wife with the brothers-in-law, and a woman with the b'nei abal, which is a stepmother with the stepchildren. So in the end, they both agree that by the stepmother and stepchildren, and their brothers-in-law with the wife of the deceased, over there, we believe that they are executors of the estate. That's true of Rav Avira, and that's true of Ravina. They both agree in that case. The only case they argue about is the Bat Eitzel Abanim. For Ravina, no Kinyan, and there she's an executor. According to Rav Avira, she inherits over there, because that's the only case that where you would say, B'kulu Kani, that was the case where they are Koneh, versus the other two cases where he said you're not Koneh. So that would be the nafkamina between these two cases is bat etzel abanim, whether she's classified as an executor or as a recipient of the assets of the estate. That would be the conclusion according to the girsa of the Rashbam. Although you can see here that it was an alternate girsa, the Ravenu Gershom has that, which is levan misha etzel abanim. And so too, v'ochana misha etzel bnei abal. If that's the case, then the nafkamina between the two positions actually is two of the cases instead of one of the cases. According to the Girsa of the Rashbam, where it's Levar Misha Yitzel Achim, Misha Yitzel Bnei Abal, the only one left over is Bat Yitzel Banim. And that would be the Nafkamina between them, where Bat Yitzel Banim, according to Ravina, would also be Apitropos, whereas according to Rav Avira, she would be Kona Et Akol, she would get everything. And that's the only Nafkamina between them. Whereas according to the Girsa that says, the var misha itzel abanim, misha itzel bnei abal. In that case, that means that he believes that those two are considered or classified as apitropsin. That means that the other two cases here, bat itzel abanim, misha itzel achim, where Ravina says she's considered to be an apitropos in all of those cases, Avira says in those two cases as well, she gets a full kinyan and there's no apitropos over here. So according to that alternate gear, so there's actually a machloket in two of the cases, Bat Eitzel Banim, Bisha Eitzel Achim. Whereas according to the Girsa of the Rashbam, there's only a machloket with Bat Eitzel Banim.